Ding remained in the hallway, walking slowly toward the elevator to keep watch while Jack and Midas slipped into Dahosha's room. Beery continued to give instructions. Ryan lowered the volume but put him on speaker so he could use both hands.
We're gonna need his password.
That might be an issue, Jack said.
Maybe a birthday?
Beery offered.
An old pet? A girlfriend? Maybe he has it written somewhere near the computer.
Jack looked around for the most likely spot for the laptop, hoping to leave the computer in the same location and condition Gaspar's men had found it. If Dahosha was unaware of the encounter, he'd continue to move forward, giving the campus a chance to suss out more information about his deal with the Russians. The charging cord lay on the desk, still plugged into the wall. It was a safe bet Gaspar's guy had snatched it from there. Ryan reattached the cord to the computer and picked up the aluminum briefcase from the floor. He used the clip of his ballpoint pen to shim the locks, feeling for the divot on each correct number as he rotated the drum. It took him less than 30 seconds to find the combination. Fortunately, both numbers were the same. Inside, he hit pay dirt with a little red notebook of ideas and passwords. It never ceased to amaze Ryan how many people went to the trouble of setting up an extra secure password and then wrote it down on a notepad they kept in the computer desk or a locked briefcase, thinking that because it was made from aircraft aluminum and had two locks, it offered some kind of sacrosanct barrier. Ryan pitched the notebook to Midas while he booted up the computer. Read me that and then take a picture of it. Ryan typed while Midas read. He stopped looking at his watch, relying on Caruso and Ding to warn him. The computer gave a soft chime when Ryan entered the correct password. On the other end of the phone, Beery recognized the sound at once.
Insert the thumb drive and it will auto-load.
Got it, Ryan said. How long will it take?
3 or 4 minutes.
It had better be 3, Midas said.
Like I have any control over that, Beery said.
It's working, Ryan said.
A GSM mic would come in handy right now, the former Delta officer said, snapping photos of the notebook pages for future reference.
No kidding, Ryan said. There were lots of things that would have been nice, but pockets fill up quickly in tactical intelligence work. Often the only lockpick was a penknife, and the only weapon little more than a steel pipe. Next to a flashlight, the item that got the most use was a credit card.
A GSM mic, Beery said. Are you kidding me? Did you guys even come to the meeting? This malware is a thing of beauty, a phone home masterpiece that hides as an innocuous system file and then calls us the moment he logs in and pops up on the network. You don't need a GSM bug in the room. You'll be able to take over the mic and camera in his computer. We'll have keystrokes in real time, see what he's seeing, read what he's writing. You can even do things to his files when he's not watching.
In the lobby, Caruso said, heading to the elevator. Midas moved toward the door. Time to haul ass, Jack.
I called both elevators to stall, Ding said, but that's not going to buy you much more than a few seconds.
Thanks, Gav, Ryan said. Gotta go.
He slipped the phone into his pocket and then wiped a droplet of the Frenchman's blood off the laptop as he watched the loading bar fill completely.
This room is full of intel, he said.
No time, Midas said.
Midas pitched Ryan the notebook, and Ryan returned it to the aluminum briefcase, spinning the locks to the same numbers they'd been on before he tampered with them. Like Clark said, when it came to security, it was all in the details. Overkill kept you alive.
Ryan made a habit of noting where his combinations were when he left a briefcase unaccompanied, so he assumed everyone else was just as suspicious.
Ryan held up both hands, giving the workspace one last scan before ejecting the thumb drive and then closing the computer.
Good to go, he said. I hope we put it back in the right place, Midas said.
The door shut behind them, and they turned to trot for the stairs.
It was a best guess, Jack said. If we didn't, maybe he'll second-guess himself.
Midas pulled open the door at the same moment the elevator chimed down the hall and the doors slid open with an audible rumble. They'd just stepped over the bodies of Gaspar's men when Ryan's cell phone buzzed in his pocket. It was Gavin.
Don't forget to clear the last device list.
Jack kept his voice to a whisper, still moving down the stairs.
The what? The computer keeps a record of devices and peripherals that are connected to it. Video cameras, DVD players, thumb drives. He'll be able to see you were on unless you delete it.
That ship has sailed, Gav, Ryan said. He's already in the room and we're out of there. How likely is he to notice it?
Gavin was silent for a long time.
Depends, he finally said, on whether he's more like you or more like me.
Okay, Ryan said. What does he have to do to see it?
Right-click the mouse, Gavin said.
Everyone good to go? Clark said half an hour later, sitting on a sidewalk cafe on Avenida del Cid, approximately 3 blocks away from the Hotel Alfonso XIII. The thousands of people who'd attended the bullfights, mostly locals, had returned home, but the streets around the Royal Alcazar Park were still modestly crowded with tourists, not quite wanting to give up on the vibrant Spanish nightlife. Adara and Caruso sat at the table with Clark, while the others loitered at various points outside the hotel itself, making it a virtual meeting over comms. Adara had a view of the Russians' rooms over her webcam. Gavin Beery was patched in via radio link. By good to go, Clark meant physically. He knew Ryan and Midas had been in a scrap, but he'd yet to lay eyes on them. They'd already told him they were fine, good to go. But Clark knew all too well that debilitating injuries had a way of showing up after the adrenaline of the incident wore off. Lucilla Fournier had proven she was wicked good at killing people. He wanted everyone on their toes. Midas said, "My nose is toast, but it's been toasted before. I can still breathe with my mouth shut, and I can't really get any uglier." His tone was light, but they'd all been hurt before, and badly. The entire team took these reports seriously. If someone was operating at half speed, everyone needed to know.
"I'm good," Jack said. "A couple bruised ribs and some ringing in my ear, but I don't think anything's broken."
"Roger that." Clark moved on, taking them at their word. "So we'll know when Dehosha opens his computer?"
"When he pops up on a network," Gavin said. "His computer will send us a notification. The malware is designed to phone home to my system, as well as whoever used their device to insert the program. In this case, it was Jack. I'll contact you when I get an alert, just in case Jack happens to be otherwise occupied chasing some piece of tail through the streets of wherever you are in the world."
"Jeez," Ryan said. "Is that what you think we do?"
"Well," Gavin said, chuckling, "not all of you."
"Enough of that," Clark said. "Good to have the redundancy. The point is that we've had no phone home from Dehosha's computer as of yet. Maybe there's a problem with the malware."
"I doubt that, boss," Midas said. "Gavin designed it to be robust as well as stealthy. It's late. Maybe Dehosha just went to bed."
Contrary to the public image of the knuckle-dragging Tier 1 military operator often imagined by the public, Midas and most of the guys in his cohort had advanced degrees, spoke at least 2 languages, and possessed a depth of knowledge and experience with phone traps, computer forensics, and other surveillance tech. Every campus operator was accustomed to working with a variety of technical means, but of all of them, Midas was the most likely to trust it.
"Midas is right," Caruso said. "From my vantage point through the window, it looked like the Russians were hanging plastic sheeting. Hindsight allows us to say they put it up to defeat any attempted surveillance, but it must have scared the shit out of Dehosha when he walked in and saw a kill room. Near-death experiences tend to spool up the drive to leave a little posterity on the planet, if you know what I mean. Good chance Dehosha and Fournier are just in there exploring their own mortality."
Adara's mic picked up her scoff.
"What?" Caruso said. "You know it's true."
Ding spoke next, bringing the conversation back on point.
"We have some choices to make. Like you said, Mr. C, everybody we've got eyes on is involved in some kind of shit."
"I'm not comfortable splitting up the team," Clark said. "A good long-term surveillance operation on either Dehosha or the man they'd marked as the lead Russian would require double the number of people he had. The relatively small size of the tight-knit team offered the ability to change direction quickly, to lift and shift, but it brought limitations as well."
"Hard to tell if the Russians or Dehosha have the ball here," Ding offered. "We need to follow whoever runs with it."
"Agreed," Clark said. "This Dehosha guy keeps showing up like a bad penny, and it's always bloody when he does. We're looking at the tip of the iceberg here."
I want to know what we're not seeing. Chapter 29. The morgue was tucked down in the basement at the end of a long hallway. A good place, Sasani thought, for handling the dead. Especially dead traitors. Mariam Farhan's body stayed where it had fallen until the IRGC officer and his men completed a thorough search of her apartment. Ali, the most pious member of Sasani's team, had covered the obscenity, but someone else had pulled back the bloody sheet, leaving her exposed during the search. Sasani thought it better that way. It would incense the men, show them what kind of whore she was, inspire them to work harder to discover her co-conspirators. After 2.5 hours of photographing and fingerprinting, Sasani had ordered the body transported to a small hospital, less than 5 kilometers north of where he'd supervised the hanging of the 3 students. He was no monster, but they were, after all, traitors, and their plaintive choking when the cranes made them fly skyward brought him no sadness. Sasani had come alone to the hospital, glad to be rid of the constant weight of the rest of his team. They were good men, but sometimes he felt as if he were dragging them along. In truth, he preferred his own company over that of anyone else, even his wife, who was always angry about one thing or another. The smell of paint and disinfectant hit him in the face as the doors to the freight elevator slid open. The fluorescent lighting in the hall had seen happier days. Several bulbs flickered off and on at irregular intervals, something Sasani used to great effect in the isolation cells at Evin. Some were burned out entirely, giving the place a ghostly feel. Sasani walked slowly down the hallway, pondering the day before him. This business with the Russian was puzzling. Dovzhenko had surely known the dead woman. The signs were clearly there. The hollow look in his jowls. The fleeting, not quite concealed flash of anger in his eyes. And where had he gone? The Russian was a spy, and spies traded in information. Some of the men had gone out for tea after they'd wrapped up the death investigation. Any spy worth his salt knew that the chatter around tea was as good a place as any to glean intelligence. But Dovzhenko had vanished. To lick his wounds, or perhaps to conceive a clever lie for his superiors to extricate himself from this mess. Sasani was willing to bet that this man was Mariam Farhad's lover. He'd gotten there too quickly, flushed, agitated. Where did a heartbroken spy go in a city that was not his own? He'd not gone home. Sasani had men watching both his apartment and the Russian embassy. No matter. He would turn up soon. And when he did, Sasani would have the necessary evidence to have the Russians turn him over to the IRGC, or recall him home to deal with the issue themselves. A delicious thought made Sasani smile. Perhaps he could persuade the Russians to send one of their interrogators to Iran, and they could work on Dovzhenko together. Reaching the end of the hallway, Sasani pushed open the double doors. He did not knock, which drew an irritated look from the woman hunched over Mariam Farhad's body. There were fewer than 500 forensic medical examiners in Iran, and only a handful with the implicit trust of the IRGC. The number of female doctors in this already small group could be counted on one hand. Sasani knew Dr. Nuri, and realized the necessity of her position. Nuri recognized her importance as well, and pushed Sasani further than he was accustomed, certainly by a woman. The examination room was well lit compared to the hallway, and felt cramped with long stainless steel sinks and tables forming an L along the back and left-hand walls. Metal doors, like small refrigerators, checkered the wall to Sasani's right. The bodies of the traitors would be behind 3 of them, awaiting a cursory glance by a male doctor and a quick burial. Mariam Farhad was laid out on the metal exam table, more of a large tray, really, with a sort of metal gutter around the edges to catch any fluids or bits of evidence that overran the paper sheet.
A white towel covered her ashen body from just below the navel to the middle of her thigh. She had bled a great deal after being shot, but what little blood remained was already pooling at the lowest points, giving her buttocks and shoulders a bluish hue in contrast to the chalky white of her face and belly. A paper tag hung from her toe on a piece of string. The bullet holes, and there were many of them, were cleaner than they were the last time he'd seen her. The effects of the swabs Dr. Nouri had used on the external examination. A rolled towel propped up her head, lifting her chin. The lid of her right eye was half open, as if she were peeking to see who'd just come into the room. Sasani took an involuntary step backward. It was an odd thing, even to him, that he could eat a sandwich while walking the dungeons of Avine Prison. But here in this place, death crawled up his shoes. The scalpel in Dr. Nouri's right hand caught a glint of light as she hovered over the dead woman's chest. Nouri was a small woman and looked somewhat like a child, standing over Mariam Farhad, who was at least 5.5 feet tall, with the touch of extra weight of a woman in her late 30s who chose convenience over nutrition when it came to diet. The paper cap and shield covered more of Dr. Nouri's face than a rosary, which was good, because she made Sasani uncomfortable enough. The blue surgical gown and dark rubberized apron obscured the shape of her body. But a wicked tongue more than made up for her modest appearance. "You should not be here," she snapped. "This is a matter of great urgency," Sasani said, unhappy at having to explain himself to anyone, least of all a woman. The fact that she had at least twice his education was of no consequence. "Have you no shame? Surely the Sepa Yepazdaran have a female operative they could send to oversee the autopsy of a woman." Sasani took a deep breath, death and disinfectant and all. "As I said, a matter of great urgency." Long-handled scalpel poised over the body, Nouri looked up to peer at Sasani, as if to say something else. In the end, she returned to her work, the blade sinking into the bloodless flesh at the left shoulder to begin the large Y incision that would open Farhad's chest. Sasani coughed. "The cause of her death is more than obvious," he said. "Is that really necessary?" Dr. Nouri paused her cutting at the top of the sternum. "A post-mortem examination can tell the entire story." She glanced at the doors along the far wall, where the other bodies were held. There were 20 of them, 5 across and 4 high, with pull handles like the deep freeze in the market near Sasani's home. The doctor continued. "We may believe we know that the manner of death was, say, hanging. An internal examination can tell us the exact mechanism of death. Did the rope cause the decedent to suffocate? Or did a lack of blood flow to his brain cause a stroke first? Such an examination could tell us if 41 of the 52 bones in this person's feet were cracked and broken. If he simply died from heart failure, at least 2 days before his body was hanged. It is written that even the bones of the living or the dead unbeliever should not be broken." Sasani glanced at the rib cutters and steel saw in the tray beside Nouri. "And yet, here you are, about to break the bones of the dead, for the security of the revolution. I ask again, is an internal examination of Mariam Farhad necessary?" Nouri dropped her scalpel into the tray. "If I am not mistaken, you are the one who ordered the postmortem." "Tell me your findings up to this point," Sasani said, happy to gain back at least some bit of control. Dr. Nouri stepped away from the body to look at an open folder on the counter behind her by the sink. "I have photographed the body from all angles." She looked up at Sasani. "I will tell you, she was quite beautiful in life. You can print them over there if you want to carry photographs of a nude dead woman with you. For evidence. I should say, that might scandalize even a major of the Sepa." Sasani ignored her. "What else?"
X-ray findings of 4 projectiles still in the body are consistent with 12 entry and 7 exit wounds.
7?
Yes, Nuri said. 2 of the projectiles likely left the body through the same wound. She pointed to 2 small holes in the side of Farhad's neck. See how these may be covered with the tip of my finger?
She cradled the head with both hands, lifting slightly to expose a gaping hole just below the base of the woman's skull.
And this could not be covered with my fist. Your bullets do a tremendous amount of damage as they exit.
Yes, Sasani said. That is the purpose of bullets, is it not?
Do you have any information of value?
She engaged in sexual intercourse shortly before her death.
Sasani did not try to hide his smile.
So there is evidence?
Of course, the doctor said. That is how I know. She nodded to several test tubes in a metal stand on a counter. Each contained a cotton swab. There is no bruising, or anything else to indicate that she fought. But I must tell you, that does not mean it was consensual.
Oh, Sasani said, I am sure that it was consensual. She was naked and smoking a cigarette when we found her.
A capital crime, to be sure, Dr. Nuri sniped.
The DNA evidence, Sasani said. He was not about to explain himself to this woman. I need it now.
That will take time, Nuri said.
Sasani clenched his jaw. I tell you again, he said. This is a matter of great urgency. I must know the ethnicity of the man.
That can be done.
Then do it.
I will begin as soon as I complete the internal examination.
There is no time, he said. I need the information at once.
Major, Nuri cocked her head to the side, as if explaining to a child why he could not have an ice cream. The science dictates otherwise.
Contrary to what you have seen in the cinema, a DNA test simply cannot be accomplished in the space of 1 hour, or even 2. Extraction, the removal of salts and other contaminants, quantification, and then amplification through polymerase chain reaction will re-
Spare me the jargon, Sasani snapped. How much time do you require?
Nuri's lips pursed behind the clear plastic face shield. She drew a deep breath in through her nose.
I will keep my explanation simple so you can understand what we are talking about. After a number of necessary scientific steps, which cannot be rushed without ruining the entire process, I will be able to separate copies of enough DNA to extract the information you need. These steps will require approximately 12 hours.
Sasani nodded.
I will expect an answer in 12 hours that...
She cut him off.
Do you read?
Of course I read.
It is a fair enough question, she said, hiding behind a seemingly genuine smile. I meant to ask not if you know how to read, but if you do. You are a busy man. Imagine a book where all the words are written on transparent paper and then stacked one on top of the other, the letters mixed and superimposed. That is what the DNA will look like at that point in the process. We have equipment that will sieve out the bits of DNA according to size. This will allow me to analyze the data and provide you with your answer.
All right, Sasani said, growing exhausted. I only need the man's ethnicity for now.
I only like the center of a cake, she said. But I must bake the entire cake to get it.
You would do well to guard your attitude, Doctor, Sasani said. Remember that I hold the keys to Evin prison.
And I hold the keys to the morgue.
I will expect a call the moment you have the information.
He turned to leave, but stopped and spun on his heels.
Or you will not need a key to gain entry into this place.
Chapter 30. The president of the Russian Federation took a long contemplative breath and looked deeply into the eyes of each of the five generals seated in front of him. Where the American White House had a quaint oval office with cozy furnishing, conducive to comfortable fireside chats and quiet conversation, Yermilov's Kremlin office was large, rectangular, as a proper room should be, and furnished with a proper oak conference table meant for getting things done. For all practical purposes, a large swath of eastern Ukraine was already Russia. It was certainly Russian. All the good citizens there needed to know was that the Kremlin would back their resistance to a heavy-handed Kiev. As far as Yermilov was concerned, he was merely helping freedom fighters return to the fold of their mother country, as he'd already done in Crimea. It did not hurt that these regions were sitting on rich supplies of fossil fuel. Comrade Colonel General Gulin, Yermilov said, waving an open hand to give the man the floor. If you please. The officer stood, straightening his crisp uniform tunic, replete with medals, including the red ribbon with a gold star, the hero of the Soviet Union medal he'd won during the campaign in Afghanistan. In his early 70s now, Colonel General Gulin had retained an erect military posture. Thick hair piled up on his head as if he'd just removed a hat. Fiercely dark eyes and caterpillar brows gave him the angry uncle look of Comrade Brezhnev, which made him perfect to bring the rest of the generals and admirals in line for Operation Aniva. The general cleared his throat and then looked once more at Yermilov before beginning.
Malware is already in place at various key locations in Ukraine's banking system and much of her utility sector. Their navy is little more than a fleet of rusty buckets, allowing us to increase pressure in the Sea of Azov with little resistance. Admiral Bilinkin has stationed the frigate Grigorovich in the Sea of Azov. The Black Sea Fleet frigates Essen and Makarov, along with destroyer Smitlivy, are en route from Novorossiysk. Four additional corvettes and three frigates from the Baltic Fleet are currently streaming through the Turkish Straits to take part in our exercise. Within days, we will double the mechanized forces in Klintsy and Volukia. Forces loyal to Russia, already inside Ukraine, will also take part in the exercise, pushing north and west toward Kiev. They will no doubt come under attack from Ukrainian forces. On your order, our troops will press south across the border to intervene, acting as peacekeepers amid the ensuing violence.
Yermilov's mind drifted as this hero of the Soviet Union went over Aniva with the rest of the staff. They were all aware of the specifics, but Yermilov wanted them all to know that he was aware, and still behind it. The Soviet action to move nuclear missiles into Cuba was called Anadyr, after a northern town on the Chukchi Sea, on the other side of the world from the coast of Florida. He'd chosen the name Aniva for this operation, after the small village on Sukhalin Island, north of Japan, far away from Ukraine. America's Keyhole and other spy satellites would observe troop enhancements and naval buildup, but Yermilov didn't fret over that. They'd been at this game for years. Yermilov was a better chess player than his predecessors were. He was already two or three moves ahead of Ryan, and with everything going on off the board, the Americans would not even know they were beaten until the game was already over.
I realize that some of you have concerns, Yermilov said when General Gulin finished. But they are, I believe, unfounded. Russia has an inherent right to conduct military exercises as we see fit. They do it, we do it. Everyone is happy. Everyone is prepared. Our Russian brothers and sisters in Ukraine expect us to rescue them from the yoke of oppression. It is our duty, is it not?
A resounding chorus of yes went around the table. Admiral Bilinkin of the Black Sea Fleet leaned back, lips pursed, as if he'd eaten a sour lemon. Yermilov's gaze settled on the man.
What is it, my friend? Do you have something else?
No, Gospodin President, the Admiral said.
I would only point out, so you do, in fact, have something else to say, Yermilov interrupted.
The Admiral slumped noticeably in his seat.
No, Gospodin President. By all means, continue, Yermilov said, now that the man was off balance. I realize that Ukraine is not a signatory to NATO, but considering President Ryan's bluster and bravado, he does not seem to know this. Perhaps, Yermilov said. Ryan certainly has the will, and he does possess the means, militarily speaking. But I do not believe he will have the time. Events on the world stage are unfolding, even as we speak, that will most certainly render Jack Ryan so busy at home that he will have no time to fret over matters abroad, to worry with a country that is not a member of NATO. His hands are full. Yermilov smiled broadly, pushing up from the table to signal that the meeting was over. It will not be long before he has too much to carry. At the far end of the office, seated along the wall instead of at the table, Maxim Dudko tapped a pen against the cover of his leather folio binder. The muscles under his right eye twitched with the anticipation. You have no idea, my friend, he thought. I will yet be invited on your little fishing trip. This conversation was far too sensitive to be held in Elizabeta Bobkova's embassy office, even in the wee hours of the morning. Too many ears there, too many spies, doing what spies did best. Bobkova had worked for Russian intelligence long enough to know that spies did not customarily murder people from the opposing team, certainly not in their home country. Traitors were one thing, but this just did not happen, at least not on purpose. Still, her orders were crystal clear. Follow through, or be recalled to Moscow. After that? That weasel, Maxim Dudko, said he was in possession of kompromat, a file of compromising information in the form of photographs, bank accounts, proof that she was padding her pockets like the rest of them were doing. Stowing away a little money wasn't a crime the president would worry over. However, if such an indiscretion were to leak, Yermilov himself would be embarrassed. In Stalin's day, disobeying an order, or obeying one and making the boss look bad, meant long and brutal conversations with the NKVD while locked in the dungeons of Lubyanka prison. After a short but detailed confession admitting to treason, if the bones in your legs were still intact enough to hobble, they marched you through the gates of the Komunarka killing grounds. Now such matters in modern Russia were handled with a subtler, though equally brutal hand. There was simply no way for her to refuse the order from Dudko, no matter how insane. She would take care of this like the professional she was, and then deal with Dudko when it was over. Two could play the game of kompromat. A man like him stank with the rot of conspiracy. There would be mountains of dirt. The weasel had actually referred to her as Lizanka, the more familiar diminutive form of Elizaveta. Only her grandfather got to call her that. But to get that far, she could not be caught, and the Americans were very good at catching. She'd gone for a long run through Glover Park near the embassy as soon as she'd ended her secure video call with Dudko. The run stilled her nerves and allowed her to work through the specifics of a plan and choose her team. The meeting tonight had to happen someplace neutral, a hotel she'd never used to meet another operative, or to administer a polygraph to a potential foreign agent. It had to be someplace not frequented by spies. No small task for an area like D.C., where spying was the national pastime. Elizaveta had taken 3 hours to drive out of D.C., picking a random Hampton Inn off Interstate 81 north of Winchester, after a meandering journey to Front Royal and through the Shenandoah Forest that was sure to scrape off the FBI agents who routinely followed her. There were several who rotated through, but she called them Bullwinkle and Rocky, no matter who they happened to be at the moment. Once she'd chosen the Hampton Inn, she used a prepaid phone to call and inform her two most trusted men of the location. She'd made no specific plans in advance, so the Americans would have nothing to intercept, and no idea where to plant listening devices in advance of her meeting.
Even so, she spoke in code, using a one-time pad so only her men could understand. The only way the FBI would have the single-use codebook is if one of these two men had turned.
If that was the case, she was lost anyway. Once she was in the hotel room, mobile phones would go in the mini-fridge, and all appliances would be unplugged.
If it had been possible to conduct the meeting on the surface of the moon, she would have done so. This assignment was beyond sensitive. It was madness. Bobkova had no moral qualms against killing. Some would say she had neither morals nor qualms. She had no problem at all giving some pesky reporter a shove, or inducing a toxic reaction in a traitor. But one fact of espionage was so bold as to be outlined in crimson in the operational training manual. Murder of the opposing team was bad business. There was nothing like losing one of their own that galvanized either side into hunting moles and rooting out spies. The FBI would devote hundreds, even thousands of agents to find the culprit. Smert Spionim, Stalin's NKVD motto of death to spies, became an all too real possibility. Notions of righteous vengeance gave everyone itchy trigger fingers. Beyond that, the real work would grind to a halt. The added scrutiny after a killing would make intelligence gathering next to impossible. Even if Bobkova was somehow able to hide her involvement in an assassination, expulsion was a foregone conclusion for anyone remotely suspected. And she did not want to leave the West. Capitalism was the main enemy, but it provided for a comfortable apartment and fresh fruit all year round. There were ways to stay, but they were unthinkable, were they not? She looked at the two men across from her in the dim hotel lighting and slid a sheet of thin onion skin paper across the faux leather ottoman before leaning back in the rolling desk chair. The men would take a moment to read the instructions. She was 99% sure that there were no listening devices in the room. But 1% was enough to blow up in her face. So she remained careful. The fewer words they spoke out loud regarding the actual plan, the better. The men smelled of heavily scented Russian soap and a shellacking of American cologne. The combination might have worked in other circumstances, but the tight confines of the hotel room had quickly taken on the assaultive odor of an airport duty-free shop. They both had mild crushes on Bobkova, and she assumed the cologne was for her benefit. It did not matter. They wouldn't be here long. And Bobkova did not plan to get any closer to either of these men than she already was. Maybe Gorov. He was young and muscular and knew how to shave his ears. But that would have to be later. To do anything now would show favoritism, which would just piss off Pugin. Even he was not entirely unpleasant to look at. Not handsome, but he would have been okay with a little grooming. Both were fit, battle-hardened, and wise to the ways of the street. Experienced intelligence operatives, possessed of the added brutish edge that made them valuable for this type of idiotic mission. She would beat the shit out of that fool Dudko for forcing her into this. If he got her sent back to Russia, she would kill him. Perhaps she would kill him anyway. Gorev rose from his stool and walked to the bathroom without speaking. He had buzz-cut blonde hair and a sad smile that belied his thuggish skills. She heard him flush the toilet. There was hardly any need. The flimsy paper would disintegrate the moment it touched moisture of any kind. Even the humid air of Washington, D.C. would render it unreadable mush in a matter of days. Gorev came into the short hall and leaned against the wall and waited for his partner to finish reading over his own briefing paper for the second time. At 40, Viktor Pugin was older than Gorev by 10 years, with dark eyes on a pie-pan face. Far too many black hairs sprouted from his ears for Elizaveta's taste. But his extra years had brought with them a certain contemplative nature that she respected. He was quick and careful, with just the right measure of each. She leaned back and folded her arms across her chest, looking at each man in turn, studying them to gauge their mood.
"An interesting choice of objectives," Gorev said, idly bouncing his head softly against the frame of the bathroom door.
Pugin peered at her over the top of his paper, putting a finer point on the matter.
The plan is workable, but the objective is insanity. May I ask where this work order came from?
Bobkova used her feet to swivel the hotel desk chair while she considered how much to tell them.
This comes from the highest level, she said.
Pugin gave a soft chuckle.
The highest level always has deniability.
She wanted to take a comb to the man's wild eyebrows, but his directness was refreshing. Gone were the days of the Soviet assassin, ready to blindly march out and do wet work for the Rodina with no questions asked, dutifully waiting for some other Soviet assassin to come along and do the same to him if he messed up, or even if he did not. Had killing someone become more difficult? No, that was not it. But getting caught was certainly easier these days. It comes from high enough, she said.
Chapter 31. Not very subtle. President Ryan tossed a pile of 8x10 photographs on the desk and rubbed exhausted eyes. He wore a pair of faded jeans and the gray t-shirt he'd been sleeping in, under a dark blue jacket with the presidential seal on the chest. Bob Burgess, Mary Pat, Scott Adler, and Arnie Van Dam were also present in the Oval. The rest of the National Security Council principals were already scheduled to arrive at the middle of the night meeting, but Burgess had gotten Ryan up early to brief him on the developments in Russia. They don't have to be, the SecDef said. It's no great secret that eastern Ukraine is de facto Russian territory. Crimea gave Moscow 50% more claimed coastline on the Sea of Azov, and more of an excuse to patrol it. Yermilov loyalists run a couple false flag operations against Russian citizens, and he can send in his troops to protect them. That makes sense, Scott Adler said. The Ministry of Defense issued a statement this morning describing this as a combination military exercise and peacekeeping force. I spoke to Foreign Minister Zubov this morning. He assures me there is nothing to worry about. Burgess scoffed. I'm sure he did.
Ryan flipped through the satellite photos in front of him again. Russian troops had been on the border with Ukraine for years, but thousands more had arrived in the past 10 hours, along with attendant armored personnel carriers and mechanized artillery units. Numerous destroyers and frigates had convoyed off the coast in the Sea of Azov, while more appeared to be en route. One photo alone showed the missile cruiser Moskva, the destroyer Preazovye, and the reconnaissance ship Pantelejev of the Mediterranean fleet moving through the Turkish Straits into the Black Sea. How about Humint? Ryan asked, dropping the photos and looking directly at Foley.
Boots on the ground suggest the same scenario that Bob does. Mercenaries loyal to Russia.
Spetsnaz troops out of uniform, dressed as little green men, Burgess said.
Yep, Foley said, giving the SecDef a side eye for the interruption.
Anyway, these mercenary little green men will likely start moving west and north, taking over radio and police stations until these installations can be liberated by Russian troops. Yermilov's peacekeepers can come in and protect the populace, and, if they are so inclined, see to rigged elections that would certainly show the lion's share of the population wishes they could run back into the loving arms of Mother Russia. Odessa Station hasn't seen any movement yet, but they're hearing plenty of chatter.
Mr. President, Burgess said, Yermilov believes we are too distracted to intervene.
It is not out of the realm of possibility that Russian troops will roll through Kiev by week's end. These videos, internet bots, it all points to Yermilov.
I'm not a big believer in coincidences, Ryan said.
I can't shake the thought that the meeting between Elizaveta Bobkova and the Iranian protest leader has something to do with this.
He looked at Foley again.
Mary Pat?
Nothing new yet, Mr. President, she said, but feelers are out and hooks are baited.
I recommend a show of force, Burgess said, before Yermilov is entrenched.
Ryan nodded.
It may come to that, he said.
Where do we stand in Cameroon?
Burgess looked at his watch. 80 personnel from Task Force Darby traveled down by truck last night from the north. The Cameroonian Rapid Response Troops are naturally worried about their own necks. They stayed behind at Garawa so they won't have to make a decision about who to support in the event of hostilities.
Ryan raised an eyebrow. I imagine N'Jaya will see that in and of itself as a decision.
I'm sure of it, Foley said, considering his record.
Ryan looked at the notepad on his desk. It was important to give people involved in this kind of incident a name.
And how about Mrs. Porter?
Scott Adler spoke next, since State was his bailiwick.
The same four men from the Cameroonian army have been with her for the duration. She's not been harmed physically, though they have been rough on her, according to Aiden Carr and Ambassador Burlingame. Water, but no food. Infrequent bathroom breaks. A lot of verbal abuse. Carr wants to go in guns blazing, and Burlingame isn't any different. Can't say I blame them. And I've been in my comfortable office and sleeping in my own bed. They've been on station for this entire ordeal.
Burgess spoke next. Two recce teams from Sabre Squadron B arrived Yaounde 3 hours ago. They're linking up with Special Agent Carr now. The Secretary of Defense rolled his eyes and shook his head. Delta Force soldiers against four exhausted Cameroonian bullies. That should take about a millisecond. They are awaiting compromise authority from you, sir.
Understood, Ryan said. If any move is made to harm Mrs. Porter, then they have my authority. He sighed.
Let's see if N'Jaya is familiar with the Battle of Pharsalus.
The Battle of Pharsalus, Foley said, admitting, where others would not, that she wasn't up on her Roman history.
Caesar's troops versus Pompey's. Pompey thought he had the upper hand, but rather than throwing their pila, he smiled at Mary Pat. Their javelins, as Roman soldiers customarily did in battle, Caesar ordered his legion to march up and thrust directly at their opponents' faces. This tactic so demoralized Pompey and his men that they fled the battlefield.
Ryan looked at Burgess. Our assets in the Atlantic?
En route now, Mr. President, Burgess said.
Good, Ryan said. Let's move this to the Situation Room. It's time to poke N'Jaya in his face.
517 nautical miles off the coast of Liberia, U.S. Navy carrier Strike Group 2 found themselves the closest American muscle of significant size to Cameroon. The 7,542 personnel, one cruiser, two destroyers, and Nimitz-class carrier USS George H.W. Bush with 80 aircraft had been steaming toward Sao Paulo, Brazil, after a brief port call in Dakar, Senegal. Flash traffic from the commander of the 6th Fleet turned them back to the east. On the flight deck of the 1,092-foot carrier, Lieutenant Sean Jolivet sat in his FA-18 and conducted a final left-to-right scan of his cockpit. There were just over 1,000 Hornet and Super Hornet pilots in the Navy and Marine Corps. Competition for each slot was more than fierce, giving the men and women who won the opportunity to fly them the bona fide right to a little swagger. Jolivet was 27 years old, 5 feet 9 inches tall, and like all the others in his squadron, living the dream. Both the Hornet's GE-F404 engines were running. Each was capable of delivering 18,000 pounds of thrust, approximately one quarter of the power of a Mercury rocket. He was in his own airplane today. Never a sure thing, since schedule rotation and maintenance required pilots to fly whatever bird was available when their number came up. Today, however, Jolivet had drawn 420, the nose of which bore his name, rank, and call sign. While the Air Force seemed to go for cool-sounding call signs, Navy tradition dictated pilots keep one another humble. More often than not, call signs stemmed from some embarrassing incident during training. Lieutenant Jolivet earned Swipe after a Tinder date during his time at Naval Air Station Lemoore, which unfortunately turned out to be with the base commander's daughter. The old man himself had given him the name, a reminder that swiping right didn't always turn out like you thought it would.
Like the other 12 carriers in the U.S. Navy, CVN-77 had the job of projecting American foreign policy around the world.
And the four FA-18s in Lieutenant Jolivet's division today formed the forward force of that projection. Lieutenant Commander Mike Gramps Wharton, the oldest member of the division, was flying 406 from the starboard catapult off Jolivet's right wing. As strike lead, Wharton had briefed the division earlier in the ready room, filling in the blanks left by the Intel O who'd described the mission.
Each FA-18 had a full warload, including AIM-120 AMRAAM, AIM-9 Sidewinders, and GBU-24 Paveway 3 laser-guided bombs, along with the wing and centerline tanks for extra fuel. Cameroon had a few old anti-aircraft guns, but the intel officer said there was not likely to be any pushback from the ground or the air. Still, when it came to fuel and weapons, Jolivet subscribed to the better-to-have-it-and-not-need-it school of thought, right down to the Sig Sauer 228 9mm pistol in his survival vest. The assistant air boss in the tower, known as the mini-boss, ran the forward cats, but an officer in a yellow shirt, catapult officers were made famous from their exaggerated dance-like, non-verbal communication movements to Kenny Loggins in the movie Top Gun, gave the go to launch. Each catapult worked independently, and Gramps' plane was propelled down the deck next in a cloud of steam. All four FA-18s in the division, Gramps, Swipe, Minion, and Frodo, would join up at an Air Force KC-135 at coordinates roughly 100 miles off the Cameroonian coast, prior to going what Navy pilots referred to as in-country. The bar attached to the nose gear of Jolivet's airplane was already affixed to the shuttle that would take him down the cat track. He was good to go. Martin Baker of the UK offered a membership in the Ejection Tie Club, featuring a commemorative necktie to those elite souls whose lives were saved during an emergency ejection in one of its company's seats. It was a cool tie, but not something Jolivet aspired to own. Still, he made certain the seat was armed. He glanced left at the catapult officer, then performed a wipeout of the controls, to be certain the fly-by-wire computer system and hydraulics that controlled the flight surfaces all functioned as they should. Satisfied, Lieutenant Jolivet turned to salute the catapult officer, who saluted him back, took one final look to make sure everything was good to go, and then dropped to one knee, pointing down the catapult. Left hand on the throttle, Jolivet reached up with his right to grab the metal bar on the upper right side of the jet's canopy. 6 seconds later, the steam catapult worked in tandem with the aircraft's engines, accelerating the jet from 0 to 150 knots in roughly 2 seconds, flinging it off the end of the CVN-77 and over the surface of the ocean. The tail dipped slightly as the onboard computer began flying the jet the moment it left the deck. Jolivet felt the sudden lack of acceleration. His right hand dropped from the bar on the canopy to the stick. At the same moment, he pushed the throttle forward with his left. The flight deck crew could launch a plane every couple of minutes. Minion and Frodo would follow in seconds. Counting the time it took them to refuel, the four-person strike team would be doing their thing over Cameroonian airspace in less than 90 minutes. Chapter 32. President Ryan kept his tone conciliatory, caging his true feelings behind the knowledge of what was about to happen. The problem with the United States and our fights is most generally what we call ROE. Are you familiar with that term, Francois?
I am, Mr. President, Njaya said. Rules of engagement.
Exactly, Ryan said. The rules under which our warfighters can unleash the devastating force at their fingertips get muddled. In our zest to be the world's police force and protect the weak, we try very hard not to harm civilians, to use a measured response. Our airmen, soldiers, sailors, and Marines often go in with one hand figuratively tied behind their backs. They act as advisors, trainers, and whatnot, when they are in actuality trained very well to inflict maximum damage on the enemies of the United States.
Mr. President, I can assure you,
hear me out, Ryan said. The United States tries to fight fair. You know that. His words took on a foreboding timbre, resolute, unyielding. It was the voice he used when Jack Jr. had taken the car without permission, the one each of Sally's boyfriends had heard when he'd first met them. Kathy said it sounded like he'd been gargling rocks. But here's the deal, Francois. War with the United States will always be asymmetrical. When our men and women go in with clear objectives, they do not falter and they do not lose. Do you understand what I am saying, Francois?
I do.
But you must understand, men loyal to you fired on a United States embassy, Ryan continued. They took innocent Americans hostage. I am sure you were not complicit in this travesty, and I will help you restore peace to your country. You can have the exact numbers later, but late last night, United States Marines arrived in Niger. About that same time, an additional company arrived in Chad. An undisclosed number of U.S. Special Forces personnel flew in last night as well. No less than 11 MQ-9 Reaper drones, each armed with Hellfire missiles, loiter over your skies. But I find the best way to deal with tyrants is through their pocketbook. 10 hours ago, I issued an executive order to what we call the Office of Foreign Assets Control to— Mr. President, please. You see, there are very few monetary transactions in the world that do not in some way touch an American bank. The OFAC has frozen sizable accounts. But with all the aliases used by your generals, mistakes will take some time to sort out. So far, these seized accounts amount to the tune of, let me find the exact figure, $109,381,953.17. Ryan leaned back in his chair, giving the other man time to do the math. Like most tyrants, he would have a very good idea of how much money he had skimmed from the coffers of his country.
Mr. President, Njaya huffed, your negotiation tactics are brutish.
We do not negotiate with terrorists, Ryan said matter-of-factly. You said yourself, Francois, these men have acted on their own, outside the bounds of your authority, outside the law. If you have a method of contact, you must tell them to stand down immediately. Tell them you have called the United States to assist you.
But I did not, really, Ryan said, dismissing the notion.
I am sure you did. In any case, that die is cast. Tell your men. Ryan's tone grew darker. Or as God is my witness, Mr. President, they will face the unfettered wrath of the United States of America. This will not be an invasion of occupation. It will be punitive. Do I make myself clear?
Jack!
Njaya was pleading now, as if he might break into tears. A uniformed Air Force aide whispered something to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, who in turn spoke to Bob Burgess. The Secretary of Defense gave Ryan a confirming nod. He held up both hands, opening and closing his outstretched fingers twice.
Francois, Ryan said, if you have a way, I'd suggest you contact your men in the next 20 seconds.
None of the 12 men had told Aiden Carr who they were with, though he suspected they were not normally the type to carry handcuffs. They had Special Forces written all over them, but the diplomatic security agent didn't really care who they were. They were Americans, and his boss had sent them to help in a matter of hours from the time the proverbial balloon had gone up. The D-boys, as Carr began to think of them, wore civilian clothing, a mixture of 5'11 tactical khakis and blue jeans, muscle-mapping polos and loose cotton sports shirts. It took them less than an hour to set up 4 cameras, 3 through tiny cracks and holes in the warehouse's metal siding, and 1 through a broken window at the rear of the building. 2 showed a clear view of Mrs. Porter, sitting defiantly but still hooded and handcuffed. Carr had gone from white-hot anger at the moment of the kidnapping to a simmering indignation over the past hours. The sight of Mrs. Porter and the 5-gallon bucket they'd had her use as a toilet brought back the rage. They'd made no move to rape her or even touch her. It appeared that they were just lazy and didn't want to take her to an actual bathroom. They did, however, take every opportunity to make fun of her predicament, like junior high school bullies kicking someone when they were down. The bearded D-boys performed their duties with detached perfection, but Carr could tell from the periodic flashes in their eyes that they felt as he did. These guys needed their heads pulled off their necks. Most of the newcomers carried HK MP5 subguns, though 2 produced Remington 700 rifles with powerful Leica optics. They were short actions, and Carr guessed them to be chambered in 308.
He caught a glimpse of a few of the men's pistols and found they carried an assortment, from 1911-45s to Glocks similar to his. The apparent leader of the team, a bearded grizzly bear of a man who identified himself only as Gizzard, had two flashbangs